All right, we're back in the secular foxhole today, ladies and gentlemen. Today we have another guest. Vinay Kolhatkar is a freelance journalist, novelist, screenwriter, and finance professional who lives in Australia. And Vinay is here today to talk about the election that happened in May down there, down under, and other things. So, Vinay, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. And good afternoon to you, Blair, and good evening to Martin in Sweden.
Yeah, and good morning to you.
Thanks.
Saturday, next day, Vinay.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
And I must say at the get-go, because Blair will do lots of talking here and great questions. You know, last time you were here in January, and then you talked about how Australia maybe become, how to say that word?
Authoritarian.
Yeah. And now you're here, and things have happened. So, and what kind of global implication that will have? So, yeah, I wanted to say that before we start. But thanks again for being a returning guest, Vinay. And shoot, Blair.
My pleasure.
Okay. So you're on your website, The Savvy Street. You wrote an editorial called "On Election Day, Australia Commits Climate Suicide." And I want to quote your opening, if I may.
Sure.
Quote. It seems to me that the widespread acceptance of the global warming dogma has become one of the main, most costly, and most undemocratic public policy mistakes in generations. The previous one was communism, end quote. And that was said by Vaclav Klaus in October of 2010.
Blair,
so what
is
happened?
Is Vaclav still active in politics, or you know that?
I don't believe so. I mean, he was president for 10 years. So yep. He's no longer president, must be a lot older. But I'm not so sure about how active he is now in the Czech Republic.
No. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it was a really strong statement and fresh air, so to speak. So please continue, Vinay.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, that is an outstanding statement. And I was thinking about saying that there are five kinds of politicians, if I may.
Go ahead.
In respect of climate change, and let's call them candidates A, B, C, D, and E. So A are the people who have recognized that this whole climate, they've recognized, they've seen through the climate scam, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
They know with facts and evidence, they can argue that human beings don't cause any kind of climate change, certainly neither warming nor cooling. There is climate change, but it's got nothing to do with industry or fossil fuels or carbon or any human activity. And A, the candidate A, is prepared to say that openly and oppose the dogma. And Vaclav Klaus, to my understanding, is the only prominent head of state over the last 20, 30 years to have actually taken this on and confronted the climate racket, if you will. So then there's candidates B, who, whilst they are in politics, stay quiet. Well, not exactly quiet. They say they accept the science. What they really mean is they accept real science, but they let this conversation meander and they say the things the media wants them to say, but don't follow it up with any action. So nod, wink, wink, they're saying to their constituencies, we don't really believe this, but we're too afraid to say this. We're going to keep appeasing this animal, but we're not actually going to take any action on it. So we kind of win on both sides. The Republicans would, I guess, have a lot of these candidates B. Then there's candidate C, who actually believe that there is human-caused global warming. We got to do something about it. But they would rather do something minimal and not interfere with the economy right now, right here, because they know that our civilization does depend on fossil fuels. So they think in 20, 30-year terms, and they want to do a little bit. And candidates D are kind of the same as C. They are genuinely convinced by the media hype, and in fact, you know, whatever the percentage of scientific papers we have that support human caused global warming. But they want to do, candidates D want to do a lot more. They want to do it a hell of a lot more by 2030 instead of 2050. And then there's candidate E, which is the evil candidate. I don't believe there are hardly any of those types. So candidate E is a hardcore neo-Marxist who knows he or she is, you know, false and evil, and they want to upset and destroy the global economy. They're nihilists, but they won't say so. So A and E are the very rare kind of candidates. Most politicians fall into B, C, and D. And we'll come to that, why that has some huge implications for both, for the entire world, for the West. So in each country like Australia, the United States, you have two very major political parties. So in the U.S., obviously, there's Democrats and the Republicans.
Right.
And the Republicans do have some of kind of candidate A, if you will. I wouldn't even count Donald Trump as candidate A because he didn't confront climate accord, the climate, the racket, but he didn't sign up to Paris. So he was more like a B. We had a prime minister called Tony Abbott. He was a B. Once he got out of politics, he began to say he became A, but he's no longer in politics and he's prepared to say it's all bullshit. His words, it's crap.
Okay.
So the Republicans, again, they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. Some of them are in the B side of things, so the candidates B. And C and D are kind of the same. They're genuine people who are misguided. And on our side, the it's called the Liberal Party, which is the kind of the religious conservatives, the equivalent of the Republicans. And they're in a coalition with a regional party called the Nationals. So the Nationals had some candidates like A and many like B. The Liberal Party had a lot of B's and C's. They had one A that they threw him out, Craig Kelly. So he became an independent. He joined another party called Palmer United. And the media really struck him off. You know, they got him booted off Facebook. Wikipedia called him a conspiracy theorist. So he was silenced.
Wow.
So you had a huge internal split in the ruling coalition, the governing coalition. Where the regional party is full of B's and C's, or mainly B's, and the Liberals were split between B and C. And part of the problem is that human beings, we have mirror neurons, and we can see through the B's. After a while, the discrepancy of a B, which and it would be similar for E, but E's, the evil bit, the evil guys, are mostly in academe rather than, or they are sort of hardcore Marxists. They're not necessarily in politics. There are a few.
Okay.
So the B's are saying some things that, you know, I believe in this kind of conventional narrative of climate change, but they're not doing anything about it. And there was, I think it was Bannon, Steve Bannon, who said politics is downstream of culture.
Sure.
And I don't quite accept that word culture in his statement, because culture can mean, you know, a commonality of literature, song, and dance that a certain kind of people share.
Okay.
I think it would be more accurate to say that politics is downstream of philosophical ideas.
Well, that's obviously true, yes. To me, and, also, yeah.
Yes. And then you have this bunch of people, a large section of the populace convinced by the climate, conventional climate narrative. So they look at candidates B and eventually see through him or her. So they would rather vote for the C's and D's. And so you have a bunch of independents or a bunch in the left who are D's. And that's what happened in Australia. They voted for D's and booted the B's out. And you had a political party split between the B's and the C's, so they couldn't have any kind of consistency. So they had to admit, in fact, and one of the regional guys I quoted him in the article, admitted that, well, you know, we just this whole climate thing is all over by the shouting. Germany's back into coal fired plants, and we have signed the accord, but we don't, you know, we don't intend to do any legislative action at all. And you had a populace that is convinced we got to do something, so they voted in a whole bunch of independents. So the Labour Party got voted into power despite the fact that their primary vote fell, because the independents eventually, you know, you have second and third preferences in the voting, and they sided with the Labour Party. And but that's going to happen, and it is happening elsewhere in the United States as well.
Yeah, well, how large is Australia's Congress, if you will, or Parliament?
The lower house is 151 seats, so the Labour Party won 77. So they have got a clear majority, because you need 76 plus a speaker. They've just got a clear majority. Yeah. But the Senate has 76 seats, and every 3 years, roughly half the Senate is up for election. So there were 40 up for re-election or election, if you will.
Okay.
In the end result of the 76, the Labour Party only has 26 and the coalition has 32. So neither of them have a majority. But the Greens, which are the overtly neo-Marxist group, has 12. And the Teals, that are independent supporting climate action, have 1. So you add 13 to the 26, you got 39. Mm. Which is a majority in the 76-seat Senate. But the majority is achieved at getting lots of candidates D. You see, Labour Party had candidates C and D. So both C and D believe in the climate narrative, but the D guys want to do a lot more now by 2030, and C want to do a lot less.
So who became prime minister, and what were his policies?
His name is Anthony Albanese. It's the Italian background. And his policies are more like C, if you will, to not overkill the animal, not to overcook, but to do more than the Liberals were promising. From memory, I think he's somewhere around 25% of net zero by 2030, whereas, you know, the candidates B were saying, we'll get to net zero by 2050, but for now we'll do nothing. So he wants to do something, but his majority in the Senate is only there because if he's backed by the Greens and the Independent. And the Greens want to do a lot more. They want to do 75% of net zero, I believe, by 2030. So they really want to kill fossil fuels now rather than sometime in 2040.
You mentioned a few people, but and are there any, not just in politics, but in public life and in the news media there in Australia that are voices of reason? Anybody?
There are. I interviewed, in fact, one of them called Dr. Ian Plimer. He's a geologist, and he's there quite often on there's this thing called Sky News, which is a Murdoch-owned And Sky News Australia has had voices of reason. You know, they largely are conservative, but they have voices that will go towards what we call candidate A. They're not necessarily in politics, but they will voice that truism, the true science, quite openly. And certainly there are journalists of the prominent ones I'd name Alan Jones and Andrew Bolt, who will say this is very, very explicitly that this is a sham. And they'll interview the right kind, the true scientists, if you will, to push their message across.
Oh, good.
Do they have international like appearance and guests and experts, or is it mainly Australians?
I guess mainly Australians, but they're quite open to having,
good.
Any voice of reason.
Talk about in the future, and I think Blair is reading my mind. So, that's good to hear. Yeah.
Now, well, of course, here in America, you may or may not be familiar with Alex Epstein and his book, Fossil Future.
I am. I've read it, yeah.
Yeah, good. You touched on this a moment ago, and one of my questions is, so in Australia, probably, obviously, like America, My guess is Marxism has nearly completed its, quote, long march through the institutions. You think that's the main catalyst that tipped this election?
I do. And even in the United States, what's happening is Marxism is on the rise. I mean, even The Guardian reported that in Europe as well as in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in the U.S., I draw attention to the following sort of websites / they are, in effect, extremely active political groups. So one of them is called Democratic Socialists of America, DSA.
Okay, yep.
And they're the ones who backed AOC, Ocasio Cortez.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And her Green New Deal and Rashida Tlaib and a few others. So, but the difference is, instead of forming a new party, new political party, or being independent, what these groups do is they push the Democratic Party more left.
Okay, right.
Mm-hmm. So there's Democratic Socialists of America, and it's an unusual name because previously you couldn't get in America a political party that openly and expressly called itself socialist until Bernie Sanders appeared on the scene and started calling himself a Democratic Socialist, and so did AOC. The word was kind of anathema, you know, but mm-hmm. not so anymore, unfortunately. So the other one is Brand New Congress, and they backed AOC as well. There's another one called Justice Democrats. And last but not the least, there's somebody called 350 Action Group, 350 rather than 360. And they're very much based on what happened, like similar to what happened in Australia. They are backed with money. And they are expressly all about climate, whereas the Democratic Socialists also have candidates who want to support eviction moratoriums, canceling rent. You know, they're Marxist across the board, versus 350 Action Group is neo-Marxist and hell-bent on a climate agenda. So what they're doing is not as visible as winning, you know, X number of independent seats in Congress, because they win it on behalf of the Democratic Party, but they are veering the Democratic Party sharp, very, very sharply left.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, believe me, I can tell. And another frightening thought is that AOC will be old enough to run for president in 2024. Not that she will, but there is that looming nightmare.
Yeah, we spoke about that. She could very well be a VP candidate if she is popular enough.
Right, right.
Is she a friend of Hillary Clinton?
Not that I know of, but I'm sure Hillary will sidle up to her.
Mm.
But anyway, just to go off point a bit, the Democrats are already tired of Biden, so they want to... The rumor is they want him just to step down for 2024, and they're promoting California Governor Gary Newsom, who's like 700,000 times worse than Biden. So anything can happen. But that's just an aside. I was going to ask, let me scroll through my questions quick here. You did make an interesting point when you said in your article that, quote, billionaires are on the, quote, on the wrong side of history, unquote. What do you mean?
So we had these in Australia, we had these independents, and there were two sets, if you will, of billionaires in the mix. One guy's name is Clive Palmer. He is a mining giant, both physically and in power and money.
Hmm.
And he formed his own political party it was quite prominent even in the 2019 election, but they didn't manage to win much. So money itself didn't talk. He backed Craig Kelly, who was candidate A, but on the whole, Palmer United was not what you'd call a libertarian or right of center. They were protectionist on many measures, but on the climate side as well, they were conflicted because Palmer himself seems to have bought into the narrative and was backing nuclear power plants. And Craig Kelly was anti this whole climate racket and very open about it. So they, another kind of billionaires are the ones who are convinced by the narrative. I believe they are genuine in the sense that they're not, you know, acting out of evil intent, but are misguided intent. And they backed a whole bunch of independent candidates who really turned that election around. I mean, 10 of them got into the lower house and one of them got into the Senate. And the Greens themselves, who have been very expressly neo-Marxist, increased their Senate representation from 9 to 12. But back onto the billionaires, we have a similar kind of problem across the world, I'm thinking, especially so in the United States. Most of the billionaires, if you will, are very much on the side of the left. I mean, you take Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or
the Bloomberg, yeah.
Bloomberg, or you take the only kind of exception, maybe Elon Musk.
I believe that's true, yeah.
But Jeff Bezos and Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg funded the election, funded about $200-300 million to get, basically to try and get Trump out and put Biden in. So they're supportive of all sorts of censorship. You know, they're running and they're controlling big tech, big media. So in that sense, the billionaires are on the wrong side of history because they are anti-free speech. They are pro either deliberately or inadvertently pro a racket, which is the climate racket. And the same thing happened here. But the billionaires here, one of them is called Mike Cannon Brooks. He joined hands with Simon Holmes Accord. Simon Holmes Accord is, I don't think he's a billionaire himself, but he's the son of a late billionaire. So he inherited a few hundred million, I guess.
Okay.
And they backed these independent candidates. And money combined with the fact that we had the philosophical ideas already embedded in the psyche of many voters, that when you combine it with marketing money is unfortunately a very powerful combination.
Let me ask you this. Do you see in the makeup of your parliament or Congress as it is now, do you see anything being blocked, any disastrous legislation being blocked or watered down? Or?
Well, the Labour Party, which is the governing party, is unlikely to promote extreme legislation. But having said that, they are promoting activism, legal activism, and that's already resulted in problems. I believe in Western Australia, for instance, that's more a state matter, but they were shutting down coal-fired plants, and they're having shortages and blackouts sometimes, and power prices are rising everywhere in the world, in fact. But part of the issue, and this is where I have a beef with the libertarians who promote nuclear power as well, is that the government shouldn't be promoting any part of the energy mix. It should just step out and let the market be. So, right. Okay, you don't ban nuclear energy, but you don't promote it. And in countries like Germany, Australia, I believe, perhaps the United States as well, and India and China, I don't believe nuclear will make the mix in a free market. Certainly in Australia, there's an abundance of coal and gas. And coal works extremely well as a base load power station. So it has to be on all the time because there's a certain amount of energy that is always consumed. It is then pretty much the cheapest source of energy. But a coal-fired station can't be just shut down and restarted in a matter of minutes or hours even. It takes more than 24 hours, my understanding is, to cool down and reheat because it's essentially heat energy. The efficiency isn't great. It's under 40% converted to you know, through the steam turbine into electrical energy. So if you shut down coal, then you have a problem because you need another source for the base load energy, which things like the so-called renewables, the hydros, the wind and solar are far from ideal, both in terms of quantity and in terms of stability and reliability. So in markets where you have lots of coal and gas, like Australia, the gas works, combined cycle gas turbines work really good for the overload. Like, you know, you suddenly have big load for air conditioning or heating during extreme weather events, and gas can be turned on and off. There's a bit of hydro in the system, which can be used for extreme requirements of energy. So in a free market, I think the nuclear won't make the mix, but if it did, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
There's no problem there.
I personally hope so, because here in Sweden, they stopped nuclear and you couldn't do a research on it. So now we are, you know, should you get like coal, so-called cheap coal from Russia, or will they turn off the gas line? So here in Sweden, it's lots of problematic future, and that's, we have a Green Party here in Sweden also, but maybe, knock on wood, they are out of the parliament in the near future, but they have also a left party or a communist party. But I think, as you said, the state shouldn't promote one or another. They should let the market be free, but here it's lots of subsidized and other things like that, so that's a problematic scenario.
Yeah, interventionism is just a cancer. It's just a plague. They think they know better than, you know, the market, or they know better than the people. It's just, it's sad and pathetic.
Talking about plague, Vinay, that probably will be the title, as you suggested. What kind of ramification and global consequences will this have with the Australian election, do you think?
I think it's suggesting that as long as, you know, as Blair mentioned, the Long March has succeeded in changing minds. All you need is some marketing money to either change the existing parties, including perhaps the Republicans, to veer left, particularly on the climate narrative, possibly on more things. But it's demonstrated that you can win and make a huge impact on elections, even running independents. But in the American election, they definitely made a huge impact by simply infiltrating the Democratic Party. So the problem we have, and I spoke about that in the editorial, that we might have to wait for a crash. But part of the problem is that if we do have a severe economic crash, we can get Adolf Hitler's out of, you know, such a scenario. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that the truth comes out just because the economy crashed. But on climate change, it's very much one-on-one, specific. A specific problem can be huge rises in the price of electricity combined with brownouts and blackouts and load shedding. In this case, there may be an opportunity to reverse this whole, you know, climate agenda. There may be.
Yeah, if enough one voice gets out, yeah, true. Let's jump off topic just a bit. What is the current relationship between Australia and China?
A little tense and fractured. Maybe it's a political football, but Australia sees China's expansionism, if you will, in the Pacific Islands a threat. But China is extremely dominant, so politicians fear China. If you say anything against them, they just stop importing some wool, or they can't afford not to import iron ore. But despite the fracture, I mean, China is Australia's biggest trading partner. So the coalition was sort of more pro-American, at least in its rhetoric. I believe the Labour Party will be more muted, try to balance the interests of China and the United States, because they need China for the economy, and they need the U.S., or we need the U.S. for security.
That is a delicate balance. Go ahead.
No, that's all I said. It is a delicate balance, yeah.
Okay. Well, so let's try to end this on a positive. Speaking for yourself, Vinay, what are your hopes and dreams for your homeland?
That's a tough one. I would rather, you know, see this happen globally, that the climate racket is exposed and defeated, including also the central banking racket. I think those are the two that are the most harmful. But I don't see any big positive signs. I see much more of what I call the deep state happening. So it's not the deep state isn't a formal network, but when you had the long march to the institution succeeds, it's not just in academia, it's everywhere, including lower levels in schools, including the
yes.
alphabet agencies, if you will, NASA and the NSA and the media, obviously the ABC and the NBC and the Guardian and all that. But even the CIA and the FBI, and obviously big tech was pretty much cultivated by the deep state, the Department of Defense and others. So as long as the deep state is getting more power, we're going to see more of the elite come to the top. And quite possibly, I mean, the World Economic Forum says so explicitly that their aim is, they don't say it in that way, but their aim is to push everybody onto a UBI.
Right.
Universal basic income. So destroy the middle class and the upper middle class. And they, you know, some of those who faithfully follow the conventional narrative might do well, become upper middle class, but most of the middle class and the upper middle class could be destroyed. And that's their aim. So I see more a fear of that rather than if I could, I would ring a positive note. But I think in the real long run, the truth shall win. So I'm not so sure how long that long run is, but particularly on climate, like I said, it's one-on-one. You know, if there's a serious problem, you can say we told you so, mm-hmm. like blackouts and price rises. Whereas the economic problems that arise can be blamed, as they have often been blamed, as they have been in the past, on capitalism or big right. corporations or big oil or all sorts
greed
of
greed and yeah, greed. Yeah, they've rolled out those excuses for centuries, you know, and they've always worked. So why not keep doing them? Yeah, but I'll tell you.
Go ahead because I want to know what's the positive from your end and Martin's end.
Sure. Yeah, I think the lockdown exposed the education establishment, the frauds that they are here in the U.S. Because they were just blatantly open about hatred of children, about they're not your children. They're, you know, we raise your children, things like that. They were just, it was so naked that parents across the country just, okay, that's it. And, the backlash is now, there used to be like less than 10% of children in the country were homeschooled. That's doubled to like 15%. And it's continuing to grow because you've got education pods and entrepreneurs bringing new ideas about education to the local level across the whole country. And I think that... those seeds have been planted, and hopefully they'll be able to grow. Now, of course, now you have the massive bureaucracy and state power still in play, but more and more parents are seeing how their children have been miseducated. So that's a huge step forward to me. And then you have various intellectuals like Michael Rechtenwald and two or three others that don't come to mind that are pushing back against the Great Reset, and they're publishing books and speaking everywhere they can. I hope to have Michael on the show soon when his new book comes out later this year. Things like that are happening, but there's not an organized movement, as so to speak, as of yet. So there is optimism. I do have optimism, but you know, the Goliath is pretty large.
The Goliath is slayable, if you will. It is, yes. There are Davids around. I think you made a very good point there that it is, for now, it is a David versus Goliath battle. But the point you made about education, that same homeschooling is on the increase here as well, in general, I believe, in the West. And yes, that could have a pretty good effect in 10 years' time, provided, I guess, you know, just privatizing education doesn't solve the issue unless that private education is, you know, true
for us.
Philosophically true in the humanities, especially in economics, exposed to the Austrian school.
And, exactly.
And the climate side of things, you're exposed to true science. So unless that happens. But if that's happening in the homeschooling, it's a tremendously positive move.
Agreed, agreed. How about you, Martin? Anything happening in Sweden?
Yeah, it's we have it like the people's home, they call it in Swedish. It's like, and that had been for a long time. You know, the Social Democrat Party had been in power for like 40 years. And then it was some others in a few periods. And now it's a mix of parties. But in a way, things are happening and it's shaking up, even if it's, you know, Northern Europe here. So, for example, this aggression by Russia and getting closer to us here. I mentioned that to Blair, for example, Kaliningrad, that's an enclave for Russia. It's very close to Gotland Island in Sweden. And so now, you know, Sweden is joining NATO, but then it's getting complicated with Turkey having issues and so on. So it's getting there, but also the satirical and parody and humor, like public service, like similar to, you know, NPR, or maybe not that, but, you know, state television and radio, the humorist and satirical guys, comedians, could now joke about it. And that haven't happened for a long time. So I see a waking up there. And also things going on in around the world. But I see positive signs there. But it will take time also.
Yeah.
But there we have that we could, in a way, wrap up and end also. That, I mean, if you fight for the future, you're living it today. So,
exactly.
As Rand said. So I will announce here, and I think Fountain have to decide if this is a winner. But we got reviewed, Blair and I, our podcast here, that you are a guest here on Vinay, the Secular Foxhole. And by some podcasters in Australia, Mere Mortals. So they did a review about our podcast.
Excellent.
And so then if you use a new podcast app like Fountain and you get a comment, like a boost, like a, if you think like a telegram, digital, with a note, and then you send a donation, like parts of Bitcoin, like Satoshi. So you could send small direct micropayments directly to the creators without no middleman at all. And then we are announcing here a guy that comment on the Value for Value podcast doing a review. Kyron did that on our show, and that it was a guy on June 17th with an app called Curecaster, and he boosted 223 sats. And that was Jake Hyder / Sleek, Sleek podcast. And his short message was, "Who is Jan Galt?" Question mark. So he's the winner, if that's because we got the split. So we got Satoshis for this. But Fountainhead had to decide if he will get the 50,000 Satoshis. If not, I will send Jake Hyder his way, Satoshis. And so that's Value for Value podcast review of our podcast, The Secular Foxhole. So I include that in the show note also.
All right, great.
Oh, it's great. It's wonderful that you've got a good, I imagine it was a very positive review, and that's excellent, because you guys have been at it for years, so you deserve a good return.
Yeah, we're coming up on year three here. We're going to start year three in September.
Great. Fantastic.
So, Vinay, it's been great having you on the show again. Tell our listeners where they can find you.
Thank you. Well, in a variety of places, I guess, but I'm quite still active on This is now the 8th year of the Savvy Street.
Great.
November will be 8 years. So, and we, as you know, we've kind of diversified into video and audio podcasts, as well as getting essays. Now we're getting them from around 50 people. So the opinion pieces still go on. It's www.thesavvystreet.com.
Okay.
Or you can just go thesavvystreet.com. I have got, you know, as you know, book publications as well, two novels and a co-authored nonfiction, which is called Media Wars, The Battle to Shape Our Minds. And I'm currently working on another nonfiction book, again, co-authored with a different co-author, Roger Bissell. You may have heard of him.
And sure.
This is on ethics and Aristotelian ethics in particular.
Nice.
Aristotle's ethics, modernizing those. And then I'm working on another, I will be working on another novel in the very near future.
Excellent.
So we, yeah, thank you.
Great. Best premises with your work, Vinay.
Very nice. Well, Vinay, once again, thanks for manning the foxhole with us.
Well, thank you for having me. And all the very best on you getting more Satoshis and
listeners and
more,
so on.
More listeners, more kudos,
yeah,
and, you know, other speakers on your show, so, and other guests. So
that's the plan.
Yeah,
that's the plan.
Thank you very much, Vinay.
All right, take care, Vinay.
You too, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Bye-bye.